Good evening. My name is Vince, and I am an alcoholic. I think I've turned into Wayne Newton. I am delighted to be here, and I am most grateful to be safe, sane, and sober, as a friend of mine likes to say. And I want to thank the committee for inviting us to Ocean City. It's been just a delight. We've had a wonderful time. It's been a vacation for us, more than it's been anything else. And we've heard some wonderful speakers. It's been just a marvelous convention. Yes. And Pat and I are just simply delighted to have been a part of it. And I know these sobriety countdowns are really terrific, especially in something this size. I mean, it's awesome. And tonight, many people stood up in their very early days of sobriety. And tonight, I'm going to talk to you. First of all, I want to welcome you to this new adventure of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the unlikely circumstance you're coming out of a blackout, that's where you are tonight, Alcoholics Anonymous. You may not know that, but this is it. The unspeakable has happened to you. You've ended up in AA. And I know if you were anything at all like I was when I was new, this is not something you sat in your high school guidance counselor's office when you were asked what you wanted to happen to you as you got older. You didn't say, "I think I want to drink like a pig and end up in AA." So if you're here tonight and you are relatively new, we've never met you, but we know a lot about you. We know how you feel. And we know what goes on inside of you. And if you're anything at all like I was when I was new, you are utterly convinced that this is a terrible mistake, that you are in the wrong place, that you really don't belong here, and that your case is different. And I would like you to know that if you feel that way, precisely because you feel that way, you are in absolutely the right place. If there's one common denominator that I think we all have, is we are utterly convinced that we don't belong here, that we are not really alcoholic, that we are not really like them. It's true that sometimes bad things happen to us, and occasionally we drink too much. And sometimes it may even look like we're alcoholic. But if you're like me, what you really know about yourself is that you have problems other than alcohol. That alcohol is not really your problem. Alcohol is more like your answer. And unfortunately, sometimes you get too much of an answer. And you get in trouble. And you end up in jail. Or you wreck cars, or you get in trouble at home, and people around you think you really ought to go to AA. And so you end up here. And so if that's the way that you feel, you're in the right place, I hope that you stay. It's certainly the way that I felt at my first AA meeting, which was a long time ago. It was in November of 1965. And it was in the basement of a Presbyterian church in Long Beach, California, in a very nice upscale part of Long Beach called the Los Altos section, which was really a very upper middle class community with a lot of affluent homes. And the AA meeting there on Friday night was in the basement of the Presbyterian Church. It was really a big deal. It was a very big, exciting speaker meeting. And everyone in the AA community in Long Beach went to that meeting on Friday night. And the most overwhelming memory I have of that meeting is that everybody there looked good. Nobody looked like an alcoholic. If you walked into that room and someone were to tell you, you are in a room filled with alcoholics, pick them out. You wouldn't pick anybody out. As opposed to this room tonight. As I look out over here, many of you look like you belong here. But nobody in that room. Except me. Now you'd have picked me out. I had on a filthy t-shirt and a ripped pair of jeans. I had not shaved or bathed in over a week, and I just spent the previous 5 days in the Long Beach City Jail due to a series of unfortunate circumstances that were not my fault. I was victimized by a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings. I don't know if you may understand that. Some of you here may have had that experience. I used to end up in the Long Beach City Jail a lot. And none of it was my fault. It turns out that the police department in Long Beach, California is fascist. And they had abused my civil rights on a consistent basis. And this was the latest of those occasions. And I ended up in the basement of this Presbyterian church. And I sat in the very back of the room, up against the wall, where most new people sit. You want to sit there because you don't want to get too close. If you don't have it, you might catch it. Isn't that right? So get away from them. And the meeting, I should also tell you, I am Irish and I'm Catholic and I'm from New Jersey. Oh, that's right, we're on the East Coast. Yeah. Usually I get booed when I say that. But we're on the East Coast. And I sat next to this guy who was about 6'5". Now, I should tell you also, I have trouble with people from Texas. We have a chemistry problem of some kind, you know. And I sat next to this guy who was about 6'5", and he had on cowboy boots and a 10-gallon hat in his lap, and his name was Tex. And Tex was not sober very long himself, but he wanted to hep me. And he told me, he said, "Boy, I'm going to hep you." And I remember thinking, you know, go hep somebody else. You know, just leave me the hell alone. But he was going to hep me. And the first thing he did is he repeated to me in rapid succession all of the AA cliches, one after another. And they're grim, aren't they? I mean, they're really dreary, if you're new. I mean, easy does it. Easy does what? And finally, he put his arm around my shoulder and he said, "Ah, keep it simple." Thought, I'll bet you do, Tex. I don't have any argument with that, let me tell you. And the meeting began. And it began much like we began here this evening. They read the 12 steps. And if you are new here tonight, and you wonder what it is we have, that's what we have. And if you are to recover here, it is required that you take them. It is mandatory that you take them. They are not suggestions. That is a lie. If you wish to recover, you must take these steps. If you take them, you get better. If you do not take them, you get worse. And you get worse while you stay physically sober right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. You have two places to go in alcoholism. You either get better or you get worse. It is a progressive disease. Nobody stays the same. Now, I know that from personal experience. It's not a theory. I sat in that meeting and I heard those 12 steps read, and I don't know about you, but I didn't hear anything new. I am educated by the Roman Catholic Church. There's nothing new there to me. These principles are really, I mean, as a matter of fact, the way they're expressed here is really rather broad brush, isn't it? I mean, if you had a Catholic school education and you sit in an AA meeting and you hear these rather broad spiritual principles, and I sat in the back of the room and I made a decision immediately, somewhere in my subconscious. I didn't sit there and rationalize it all out, but somewhere in my subconscious I said, my case is different. I am not like you. So I dismissed those 12 steps. Oh, I could see where they might work for you if you're not very bright and Protestant. But my case is different. I am not like you. And the meeting began. And it was a good meeting. And several people participated. And I don't remember what they said, but it was innocuous and it was inapplicable to my life, as near as I could tell. These were nice people who, it seemed to me, what I heard was a collection of very nice people who somewhere along the line drank too much. And then they came to AA, the Presbyterian Church in Los Altos. And then they stopped drinking and went back to being nice people. My case was certainly different. I had far more grave problems than that. But that's what I perceived. And at the end of the meeting, if I had any doubts as to whether I belonged there or not, they had something that is absolutely embarrassing. They celebrated AA anniversary birthdays. I suppose you do that here in Maryland. Don't you celebrate birthdays, anniversaries? We call them birthdays in Southern California. And they have cakes with candles on them. I mean, good God. And they sing happy birthday. I mean, a room full of middle-aged people singing happy birthday to some moron who hadn't had a drink for a year. And he blows a candle on a cake out. And then he gets up, and there was a series of these. It's like something that should take place in a mental institution, isn't it? Really, something like that. In the day room, right after dance therapy, you know. We'll have birthday parties for the drunks. And they had a series of these birthday parties. And one in particular for a woman who was about 110. And apparently she was sober forever because they had a fire on top of this cake, I'm telling you. And she got down to the aisle and she blew the candles out. And she got up here and she said her name was Phoebe and that she was an alcoholic. And then she said something about, did I want what she had? Not tonight, Phoebe. I don't think so. Now, that was my first AA meeting. And I think it's safe to say that I did not have a spiritual awakening. But I will tell you what I did. For the next 3.5 years, I stayed sober in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. As physically sober then as I am tonight. And during that period of time, I did everything there was to do in AA. I participated in Alcoholics Anonymous in virtually every way that you can participate. Except for one thing. I did not take these steps. And as a result, my alcoholism got worse. And it got worse while I stayed sober and busy in the middle of AA. Recovery from alcoholism does not come from making coffee in AA meetings. Recovery from alcoholism comes from change. Spiritual change. I did not take these steps. Consequently, I sat in the middle of AA, and it's a terrible place to be. There are people here tonight exactly in that state of mind and body. You've been here some appreciable length of time. You're very busy in AA, but you are not involved in these steps. And you're getting worse. And you know you're getting worse. Because you're surrounded by people who are getting better. And you can see them get better, can't you? Recovery here is visual, isn't it? You can watch somebody get better here. Does anyone ever have to tell you that they're recovered here? You just need to be around them. And you can watch them. Something happens to them. Their eyes change. Their face changes. Their persona changes. They have a sense of purpose. They have direction. They're going somewhere. But not you. You're arrogant and lonely and hostile and judgmental. And if you're like me, you sit there and you say to yourself, when does that happen to me? When do I get mine? I used to think you had secret meetings. Have you ever had that feeling? Where they all met without you and shared what really was, what it was that, you know, that's the way that I've been. Now, intellectually, that's ridiculous, but psychologically, that's what happened to me. On the outside, good things happened to me right away. I was in the military and received some excellent medical training. As a matter of fact, that I should also tell you, I'm going to talk a little bit about my family tonight. I come from a wonderful family, a kind, loving, nurturing family. I am the fifth child in a family of five children. I had four older sisters. My youngest sister was 11 years older than I was. And I was born very late in my parents' life. I think my mother was 40. My father was 45 when I was born in 1940. And all of a sudden, this family with all these girls, along came this boy. The crown prince had arrived. My sisters would fight over who would get to babysit for me. They would take me on dates with them, for God's sake, as a little kid. They would, you know, my father worshipped me. My father adored me. My father, my earliest recollections of Christmas are my father in my bedroom in the middle of the night on Christmas Eve at 4 o'clock in the morning, kneeling down beside my bed. He would wake me up and he would say things like, I just saw the sleigh leave. Let's go downstairs. And the entire family would go downstairs and celebrate Christmas because my father couldn't wait till morning. I was not abused. I was nurtured. I was loved. I was cared for. I was educated. Now, my parents died within 1 week of each other when I was 12 years old. Now, that's a tough thing. There's no question about that. It's hard on a 12-year-old kid. But I was surrounded by these sisters who had now married and all married great guys. And I was surrounded by these people and cared for and loved. So I never missed a beat. I continued on. Now, I became what is known as a behavior problem. Anybody identify with that here? Long before I ever took a drink of alcohol, I am in trouble. Do you understand that? A lot of trouble, all the time. I ended up through a series of misadventures in the Navy, and I got a very good medical education. They sent me to one medical school after another, culminating with a medical administration school, and they commissioned me an officer, made me an ensign in the Medical Service Corps, and I was sent to Okinawa, attached to the Marine Corps. And I ended up attached to the 3rd Marine Division on Okinawa, sub-attached to the 5th Marines, which is these are the guys that raised the flag on Iwo Jima and me. It was not a good match, I will tell you. I was sent there as a medical administrative officer. They couldn't find a job for me, so they put me in an officer's club on the northern end of Okinawa. And they forgot about me. And I forgot about them. And my duty consisted of getting up in the morning and reporting to the cocktail lounge of this officer's club, drinking Hagenhaeg Pinch at 60 cents a pop. Very good investment, I will tell you. And pretty soon they put another guy up in that officer's club, and he was a surgeon out of Temple University who was a very bad drunk, and they didn't want him around patients. So they stuck him up in this officer's club along with me. And we bonded, he and I. And we both, the Marine Corps forgot about both of us, and we forgot about them. And we just kind of forgot we were in the military, quite frankly. We both reported to the cocktail lounge every morning, and we grew beards and wore shorts and lost all our uniforms at one point. You couldn't even find any. And so finally they caught up with us, and they decided that we needed a job, and they put us in charge of venereal disease control for the island of Okinawa. And our job, what would happen, these Marines would get gonorrhea and syphilis and lymphogranuloma. They get hideous venereal disease that you've only seen in books and in Marines, as it turned out. And our job was to go around to the villages and find the young ladies in question and, well, use your imagination. We would, go ahead and treat them. And so we had this awesome power to quarantine these bars. We could close them up. And so what we did was ride all over Okinawa in a jeep. And as soon as they'd see us coming, they'd set up the scotch. And, I don't think we ever closed one bar in our entire tour of duty. And our tour of duty came up, and we came back to the United States, and he went on back to Temple and finished his residency in cardiovascular surgery. And as far as I know, he's never gone to AA. So I guess if you need a bypass, stay the hell out of Philadelphia. Best I can tell you about that. I, on the other hand, did what most... do you remember that point in your life when you were young and you knew something was really wrong with you and you couldn't identify it? You were not ready to call it alcoholism, but you knew you were different because your peers all seemed to be socializing, completing their education, doing things that you seemed to be incapable of doing. And yes, you drank too much, but you didn't really think you were an alcoholic, but you were confused and you wanted to make an effort to fit in. So you do what everyone does when that happens, you get married. Right? And that's what I did. I got married. I married a girl that I met in the Navy. She was a Navy nurse, and to say that we were incompatible is to understate it. We never should have had a second date. Do you remember those kinds of relationships? That's what happened. We got married, she got pregnant, we moved to Southern California and moved in with her parents. And I got a stop. I was going to start school in that fall semester, and I got a stopgap summer job as a bartender. And you can imagine how that worked out. Within 3 months, I was they threw me out. I found myself on Balsa Avenue in Santa Ana, California, with very little money and a lot of Samsonite luggage, and I needed a job. And I found a job as an ambulance driver in Orange County. And I was to drive an ambulance for the next several months drunk in Orange County, California. And when I tell you I drove it drunk, I never drove it sober. It used to frighten me sober. I had to be drunk to get near the damn thing. And I'm a blackout drinker, which made a lot of the ambulance calls quite colorful. I have come out of a blackout with the lights and the sirens going, and I'd have to turn to the guy next to me and say, where are we going? That would unnerve him, I will tell you. He would get very upset. One night, we got stuck in a cul-de-sac going around in circles. You know what I mean? Came out with the light on the top of the siren going in Newport Beach, going around this cul-de-sac at 3 o'clock in the morning. You know how you lock onto something and you just can't... And I came out of a blackout. We were just going around this circle. The light on top was shining in these people's bedroom windows, and everybody's coming out on the porch in their bathrobe just watching this ambulance go around this circle. And finally, they sent a police car in to lead the ambulance out. And I lost that job shortly after that. In addition to losing my driver's license forever in the state of California. And that's the package I brought with me to that very first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1965. But a new profession had opened up in civilian medicine shortly after I got sober in 1965. It was called the Physician's Assistant Program. And for many of you, I suppose a lot of you know what that is today, but in those days it was a brand new concept. And the reason for it essentially was that the medical schools were producing a lot of physicians who were all specializing, and there weren't enough guys to do primary care medicine in the emergency rooms. So they took people such as myself, who had this rather sophisticated medical training, and we were the first PAs, and we went to work in the emergency rooms. And I was the third licensed PA in the state of California, and I went to work in an emergency room at night in East Los Angeles. Now, I don't know if you've ever been to East L.A., but that's quite a place to be in an emergency room at night. And I was the night guy in that emergency room. And it was really a very good job. I was in on the ground floor of a new profession. And by then I met another girl, a beautiful girl, a daughter of a longtime sober AA member, as a matter of fact. We fell in love and we got married. She went to Al-Anon. We were just very precious. I mean, I was young, had a great job. She was beautiful. She was in Al-Anon. Things were really going to work out for us. But there was one thing wrong. I had not taken these steps. And there was no recovery. And I would go into this emergency room at night. And I would get depressed. And I would get anxious. And I would get not up to the task. And I would get lonely. And I would get all of the things that you and I know about that happen to you and I when we're dry and we're not sober. Now, I don't have a spiritual program, but I have a relatively good medical education. So I know how to take care of depression. I use Dexedrine. 15 milligram spanchols work best. And by the time I was done with those, I was taking 6 or 7 of them a day. Now, if you know anything about amphetamine abuse, you will understand. That's got you moving right along. Whatever you're doing, you will do it in a hurry, let me tell you. But there's a problem with that. Along about the 5th or 6th day, when you've not slept nor eaten, and your hair stands up on end like that, and your eyes dilate out over here like this, and you show up in the emergency room to help the sick, it does not look good. The guy you're relieving never wants to go home. They say things to you like, Vince, you need to get something to eat. But fortunately, there's an antidote for that. And it's a drug called Demerol. Everybody knows about Demerol today in AA, don't you? And Demerol, incidentally, is a narcotic. It's not really, it's a synthetic, but it's close enough, trust me. You don't need to worry about it. And narcotics are addictive, and it's different. Well, I'm not going to go into that tonight. But anyway, I began to use Demerol in this emergency room. And there's another problem with drugs like Demerol and morphine and Dilaudid. People care about where they are. You know what I mean? In the morning when they come in and they would open the narcotic drawer and all the dope would be gone, they'd say things like, Vince, where is the Demerol? I'd say, I don't know. It was here a while ago. But the real problem with that is the Medical Quality Assurance Board of the state of California. They're the people who care the most about Demerol. And they came in there one night and inspected the narcotic logs and placed me under arrest. Charged me with a felony appropriating narcotics for my own use. And they took me right out of that emergency room to the Los Angeles County Jail. That was the program for impaired physicians in 1968. Now, they reduced that to a misdemeanor, and I didn't have to go to jail, but I lost my medical license. And I ended up, the long and short of it, is I ended up spending the summer of 1972 living in an apartment by the airport in Englewood, California, drinking 1/2 gallon of vodka a day. And that's how it ended for me. And I don't have to describe that kind of drinking for you. You know all about that. And people who drink 1/2 gallon of vodka a day, incidentally, are alcoholic. They are not social drinkers. Social drinkers do not drink 1/2 gallon of vodka a day. And my wife left me and took all the car and the furniture, and it left just me. I had very little money, and I would walk over to and buy supermarket brand vodka at $7 a 1/2 gallon out of the wire cage, you know, down in the front by the cash register. And I would take it home and drink it in the middle of this apartment living room floor, hot, in August. That was the end of the line for me. I am a terrible blackout drinker, and I came out of a blackout in Newport Beach. And I don't remember how I got there, except I became cognizant of where I was, sitting on a park bench next to the Balboa Peninsula in Newport Beach in early September 1972. The temperature was about 110, and I had on a three-piece wool suit and a white shirt and a tie. And I became conscious of where I was. And I knew I needed a job, so I bought the Orange County paper, and I looked through the classifieds, and I found a job as an apprentice embalmer for a mortician, which was the only job I could get. And if you're new tonight and you need a job, don't do that. I don't recommend that. It was very, it was an awful, the job paid $80 a week, and a fringe benefit was this apartment over the room where they kept the caskets. So in the morning, you'd get to walk through the casket room with a hangover, which would really set you free. And that's what I did. And I got in a, the mortician, I didn't like him, and he didn't like me, and I got in an argument with him, and I got drunk and stole his hearse. And on September the 20th, 1972, I came out of what I hope is my last blackout, driving the wrong way on Pacific Coast Highway in Newport Beach in a stolen hearse with a young lady with me who I did not recall meeting, actually, who was screaming at the top of her lungs because we were going the wrong way. And I remember thinking, I really have a character flaw. I tend to get involved with neurotic women. You know, I really do. And I told her, you know, you're very unstable. You ought to get some counseling. That was September the 20th, 1972. And from that date to this, I have not had a drink of alcohol, nor have I used any mood-altering chemical whatsoever from that day to this. And that will be 27 years next week. But no, that's not a big deal. What's more important about that day is if you could have materialized in the back of the hearse and foretold my future, what you would have told me would have been amazing. You would have said, today, you're going back to AA. And for the next almost 27 years, you're not going to drink. You're not going to use any chemicals. But something else is going to happen that will be even more amazing. You, for the first time in your life, will have the existing condition inside of you that I believe is necessary for recovery. For the first time in your life, you will be desperate. Desperate enough to take actions you do not believe in, direction from people you do not like, and become willing to do things that you don't think will work and seem totally inapplicable to your life. And that's the condition I was in 1972 on September 20th. I went to the Costa Mesa Alano Club right off of Newport Beach. And that's an AA, you know, an Alano Club, and many of you know what they're like. And they had a coffee bar, and I sat at the coffee bar, and I had a cup of coffee. And they had an AA meeting there that noon. And it was a terrible meeting. It was awful. It was 7 out-of-work Texas plumbers, you know. Oh, it was terrible. And they had a meeting there that night. But I didn't have anywhere else to go, so I stayed. And the manager of that club allowed me to sleep on the sofa. And in the morning, I got in a gin rummy game with some women there, and I won $20. And I rented a room for $11 a week on Federal Avenue in Costa Mesa. And it was a terrible room. I don't know if you've ever seen an $11 a week room. They're all the same, aren't they? They're generic. And I remember looking at this room and thinking, good God, I don't think I can... I'll clearly have to live here for several weeks. And I don't think I can live there that long. 2 years later, when I moved out of that room, it really didn't look that bad. Your perspective changes, I will tell you. So I spent my first 2 years of sobriety in Orange County. And I want to tell you, The exact reverse happened to me as to my first experience in AA. Good things did not happen to me. I did not get a good job. My medical license was gone. I was virtually unemployable. I got and lost jobs that were ridiculous. I lost a job as a gas station attendant for being incompetent. I lost a job as a $1.87 an hour drill press operator, where all you had to do was sit on a stool and pull a handle and put a hole in a copper plate. And then you take the copper plate and you put it over there. And you take another copper plate and you pull the handle again and you put a hole in that one. You just did this repetitively all day. You could not do it wrong. I put the hole in the wrong place in about 1,000 of these copper plates one day. And the foreman came up to me and said, "You know, we've got to let you go." He said, "It's really too bad." He said, "Because I can see you're trying very hard. But you're really not quite bright enough to do this kind of work." And I told this jackass, who was from Texas, where I went to school, and he said, "Well, I'll tell you what, son, you ought to go back and take the course in drill press operating, you know." And I lost that job and ended up walking back to that dreadful Olano Club that day in the pouring rain. And I was several months sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was terribly depressed. And I didn't know what was going to happen to me. I didn't know what I could do or where I could go or who I could call. All I knew was I was going to AA meetings every night. And there was a guy that used to hang around in that Olano Club, and his name was Clarence. And he was in the floor covering business. And he was from Texas, too, incidentally. But he was really a nice guy. And he said to me, "How would you like a job? I will hire you. I will pay you $10 a day to carry the floor covering and go get coffee and carry the tools. And when we're through, I'll give you your $10 and I'll take you to dinner." My overhead was not high, so it sounded like the presidency of General Motors to me. So I went to work for Clarence as his gopher. And every day I would carry all of the floor covering, I'd carry his tools, and I'd do what he wanted. And at the end of the evening, we'd end up in a restaurant, and he would buy me dinner and give me a $10 bill. And that's how I lived. And along the way, I began to acquire some material possessions. I remember I got a 1964 red Chevrolet convertible with no brakes and a hole in the top. And I used to drive that down to the big meetings on the peninsula in Newport Beach, down by the Ebel Club. Carol knows where that is, which was really a very big upscale meeting. They'd all tie their yachts up outside and they'd go into this AA meeting. And I'd pull into the lot in my Chevy, and they'd immediately get into their Mercedes and put them on the other side of the lot. You know. And they were always asking me questions like, "Do you have insurance on that car?" I hadn't had a driver's license in 3 years. Why the hell would I have insurance? You know, redundancy. And that's the way that I went to meeting. My first birthday came and went. And then my second birthday came. And I was 2 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was working for a carpet layer. And I had no hope and I was sober. And I was beginning to have some kind of a relationship with a higher power. I know one night I came back from a meeting in Newport Beach in the pouring rain. I felt so discouraged. Almost a year sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I just lost a job as a drill press operator. I had bronchitis, and I had a fever, and I got caught in the pouring rain walking home from a meeting. And the speaker that night was somebody Pat talked about last night, Norm Alpie, who was maybe the quintessential speaker in Alcoholics Anonymous. You could not listen to this guy and not get inspired. But yet I got depressed. And I walked back to this room in the pouring rain. And I was so alone and so hopeless that I got into that room and I did something so stupid, I can't believe I ever did it. I got on my knees beside the bed and said a prayer. And it was a prayer of desperation. And it was very simple. It was only, "God, please help me. I'm afraid and I'm alone and I can't make it anymore." My recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous began that night. And if you are new here tonight, that is how you begin. It is not necessary that you believe in that God or have any faith in that prayer. Alcoholics Anonymous is about action. It is about willing to take actions that perhaps you do not believe in. And something happened to me as a result of that evening and subsequent evenings and mornings after that, when I began to also say a prayer in the morning, which was simply, "Thank you. Thank you for keeping me sober one more day." My second birthday came in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew I needed help of a more practical nature. And I decided to get a sponsor. Now, I don't recommend that you wait 2 years to get a sponsor if you're new there tonight. But this is what happened to me. And the reason it took so long is because I knew who the sponsor had to be. And I did not like the idea. I didn't like this guy. He was mean. And he was crazy, too. I mean, if you listen to the guy speak in AA, you knew he was nuts. He was a big speaker, and he spoke all over in Alcoholics Anonymous, but he was totally insane. But there was something about him that was indisputable. He had this amazing capacity to help losers in Alcoholics Anonymous. The hopeless cases of AA would go to this guy, and they would join his fascist AA group on the west side of Los Angeles and do things that were completely incongruous in my view. I couldn't understand. But they would disappear from Orange County, and they would join this group, and they would get him for a sponsor, and their lives would change. They would show up months later with jobs and cars and dental work done, and, you know, and it was incredible what would happen to these people. So I called this guy, and I asked him if he would help me. And he told me to come and meet him at this mission he ran on Skid Row in Los Angeles. So I drove this old Chevy down to Skid Row in L.A. And I went in and had lunch with this guy. And I asked him to help me. And I'll never forget what he said. And if you are new here tonight or relatively new, I help. Somebody says something like this to you someday. Because to me, it was the beginning of my life. He said to me, "I will help you on one condition, that you can accept the simple proposition that your judgment about your life is terrible, and that my judgment about your life is infinitely better than yours. And if you will do everything I suggest you do without debate, I will help you." Well, I am here to tell you I was just desperate enough that day to make that unholy pact with the devil. I agreed to do it. And the first thing he did was he looked out the window and he said, "Do you have insurance on that car?" I wonder how he knew that. He said, "You don't have a driver's license either, do you?" I wonder how he knew that. He said, "Give me the keys to your car." I said, "Give you the keys to my car? Why should I do that?" Then he said the most profound thing I've ever heard. He said, "I'll tell you why, kid. You ought to give me the keys to that car because law-abiding citizens such as myself have a right to drive on the city streets free from fear from morons like you." I gave him the keys. I mean, how do you argue with that? He said, "I'm going to take this car and park it in front of my house in Venice, California." Yeah, if you've ever been to Venice. And I have some things I want you to do. And when you get a driver's license and you get some money and you get some insurance, I'm going to give you the keys back. And you can have your car back. But until then, it stays parked in front of my house. But don't worry, you're going to get to visit it. He said, "The next thing I want you to do is I want you to move into this mission and live here." I said, "My God, I'm looking for upward mobility. I mean, I live in Newport Beach. Why the hell would I want to move into a mission on Skid Row in Los Angeles? And he said to me, do you have a better idea? Which always kind of got me, you know, I mean, I never really had an answer for that. So I moved into the mission. And he said, I'll tell you what I want you to do. I want you to put on that three-piece suit you have and report to my office every day at 10 o'clock in the morning, 9 o'clock in the morning. And I'm going to give you an allowance. I'm going to give you $8. And I want you to take the $8, and I want you to go outside, and I want you to get on the 83 bus that runs up Wilshire Boulevard. And when you get on the bus, ask the bus driver for a handful of transfers. Because every time you come to a hospital or a medical facility between downtown Los Angeles and the San Fernando Valley, I want you to get off the bus, go inside, talk to the administrator, tell him you're 2 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, that you don't drink, that you don't need drugs, you need help getting your medical license back, and you need a job. And then when he tells you no, go back out and get on the bus and go to the next one. Now I thought to myself, that is the most preposterous, stupid, ridiculous. I mean, that is idiotic. It will never work. That's what I thought. What I said was, okay. So every day I reported to this guy's office and I got my $8. And I got on the 83 bus. And I must tell you, I lived in the Midnight Mission on Skid Row in Los Angeles for 8 months. 8 months. And I did everything he said. I reported to his office every day. I got my $8. I rode that bus. I went into every medical facility between downtown Los Angeles and the San Fernando Valley maybe 10 times in that 8 month period. And nobody could help me. Nobody could help me get my license back. Nobody could help me get a job. I was right and he was wrong. And I would go and tell him that too. I would say, not today. It didn't happen today either. And he'd tell me, why don't you shut up? Or something spiritual like that. And every Saturday morning, our group would meet at his house and we'd go across the street and play softball. And then we'd go back to his house and have hot dogs in his backyard. So I would get to visit my car. And my car stayed parked. And I don't know if you've ever parked a car for very long in Venice, California. But my stay in the mission, of course, was longer than we thought it would be. And I didn't get to make any money. I didn't get a driver's license. So I got to watch my car decompose in front of this guy's house over a series of several months. I mean, I remember going, and everybody playing softball would gather around my car every Saturday. It was a ritual. And they would look at it and they'd say, hey, Vince, look, the top's gone. And they would laugh. I did not laugh. They laughed. One Saturday, the entire steering column was missing. You know, the top was gone. The steering column was missing. And then a couple weeks later, somebody took one wheel. You know, why the hell would anybody take one wheel off the 1960s? But they did. And the car sat on three wheels like that, with no top and no steering column. An empty shell, much like my life. And then one Saturday morning, finally the final insult. There was nothing left but an oil spot. Symbolic of my life. And I would go back on Monday morning and I'd get my $8 and I'd get back on the 83 bus. And I was there 8 months. And finally, one Friday morning in June of 1975, I was 2 years and 8 months sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have a job. I didn't have a car. I had no connection with a family. I had no money. I had nothing. I lived in a mission on Skid Row. I didn't know anybody doing as bad as I was in AA. I couldn't think of anybody. And I got this miserable $8 and I went outside and got on that crummy bus one more day. And when I got on the bus, the first thing I did was I sat down in a huge wad of chewing gum. Got it all over the back of my suit. And I rode halfway up Wilshire Boulevard and I got off the bus and I went into a service station, a union station. I went into the men's room and I found myself standing in the men's room of the Union 76 station on Wilshire Boulevard with a three-piece suit on, a shirt, a vest, a tie, and my pants in this hand and wet paper towels in this hand, trying to clean chewing gum off the... Have you ever tried that with a wool suit? It didn't work. The gum went all the way down. Oh, it was awful. It was just a disgusting mess. I remember looking at myself in the mirror and thinking, I am the most grotesque human being that I have ever seen. And I don't think I have it in me today to stay sober another day. What's the use? The only thing I can do, perhaps, is sit in a movie. If I sit in a movie, maybe I won't drink. So I put my pants back on. I went outside. I got on the bus. I rode to the end of the line to Santa Monica by the ocean. I got off the bus. I went into a cafeteria, the kind where you take a tray and go down the line. And I went down the line, and I got some food, some lunch, and I set it on a table. I went outside to buy a Los Angeles Times, and the busboy came by and took my lunch. I mean, this is what kind of a day it was, let me tell you. So I walked from Westwood Village, from Santa Monica, the mall in Santa Monica, to Westwood Village by the UCLA campus, to the movies, to the Bruin Theater. And I stood in line to buy a ticket to the movie. And the movie was The Godfather 2. The name of the film. And I was standing in the line to buy that ticket, and somebody called my name. And I turned around and came face to face with the administrator of the medical center in which I was arrested in for using Demerol. And he said, "My God, what are you doing here?" He said, "It's really good to see you." He said, "You look great." It was the middle of a Friday afternoon, and I was standing in the movie line, sober and free from drugs. And he said, "You look marvelous. We were so worried about you. We thought you were dead or in an institution. How are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm okay. I'm sober 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous." And he started to cry. And he put his arms around me. He said he was so glad to see me. And he said, "When have you worked last?" And I said, "I haven't worked in a long time." He said, "That's amazing. We have a urologist who's just joined the group practice. He's a member of the Medical Quality Assurance Board. He's going to be down in the clinic tomorrow. I want you to come down and meet him. We will have lunch. Perhaps he can help you get your license back. And if he can, how would you like a job?" Back in that same emergency room. I went down and I met that urologist the next day. We had lunch. He wrote some letters. Within 60 days, my medical license was restored in the state of California. I went back to work in the very same emergency room in which I was arrested in for stealing drugs. And I worked there for the following 2.5 years. And I will tell you that no drugs were missing. And the patients got good care. I know. I gave it to them. And during that period of time, I took these steps, 1 through 12. And my life flourished. I changed. And that is what you must do if you are new. And you must take these steps in order, as they're written, in that book, 1 through 12. When you write that inventory, it is a searching and fearless moral inventory. The word is not there by mistake, the word moral. It's there on purpose. That's what it's about. It is not a psychological inventory designed to get you in touch with your feelings. Nobody here cares how you feel. We care about what you do. If you take the action, your emotions will follow. And I took these steps. I wrote that inventory. And when you get to steps 8 and 9, they're exactly what they say. They're your worst nightmare. They're what you think they are. You must pay the money back. You owe it, you have to pay it back. And we went through these steps. I took this inventory with this Nazi sponsor. And I will tell you, incidentally, he is still my sponsor today. And that's a long time now. Our relationship has changed. And I have lunch with him every Wednesday. And he tells me he thinks I ought to pay him his $8 back. But our life was good. And my life flourished. And that is not to say that I didn't make mistakes. I made every mistake you can make in Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety. I mean, I made them all. But you don't get drunk here from making mistakes. You get drunk from defending them. That's how you get into trouble here. You get nothing more than human here. Nobody graduates above that. You get just to be a human being. And wonderful things happen to me. In 1975, I met Pat. When I met her, she was new, and her husband was dying of lung cancer. I watched Pat get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous while she took care of a dying husband, which is no small feat, I will tell you. And I watched her do it, and I saw this wonderful human being, and what a wonderful woman she was, and what a wonderful wife she was to this man. And he passed away, and we began to date. We fell in love, and we got married, and now I'm married to the same woman for 19 years. I can't do that. That's not possible for me. I don't have that kind of a track record. I don't have that kind of stability. I don't have that kind of staying power. And yet here we are. It's 19 years later. And our marriage is better today than the day we got married. There is nobody's marriage I would rather have than mine. I hope you can say that if you're new. If you are new and young and male, I have some valuable information for you. I hope you hear it. It will save you grief beyond words. It is this: women are not the enemy. They are your partners. Your loving partners. Now, I should tell you how remarkable this really is. I am so different from the rest of my family. I come from the stable family. They're Irish and Catholic, and there aren't any other alcoholics that I know, which is amazing, isn't it? That's like heresy in an AA meeting, isn't it? In our family, there are a total of 4 divorces that I know of. 3 of them are mine. Yeah. There is the dichotomy. But my life flourished as a result of these steps. I got out of medicine. I got into a new business in vocational rehabilitation counseling. We made a lot of money. Wonderful things happened. Then bad things happened. We lost a lot of money. And we had heart attacks. There were heart attacks and bypass surgeries and all the things that happen in life. And they'll happen to you too if you're new. You don't get immune from that. There is no immunity from living here. There is just simply a way to walk through life like an adult, which is all you really wanted anyway, with self-respect and dignity. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. And I have bad days today. But I'll tell you what happens when I do. I have an office over Wilshire Boulevard. I have an office with a picture window over Wilshire Boulevard. And when I get down, you know what I do? I swing that chair around, I look out that window, and I look for the 83 bus. Still comes up Wilshire Boulevard. And every time it passes by, I feel okay. Because I got it better than I ever thought I would. My life is simply wonderful. And if you are new here tonight, before I sit down, I want to tell you so you know why you are here. Alcoholics, you are here not because of any great innovative scientific breakthrough. That didn't happen here. That's not why we're here. All of the science and all of the history of the world could not... There are more sober people in this room tonight than there were anywhere in the world prior to 1935. You're here tonight because of what happened on May 11th, 1935. That's why you're here. Because a broken-down, beat-up stockbroker who was a terrible alcoholic, an awful alcoholic, a convulsion-seizing kind of a drunk, a hopeless drunk. He'd been in every drying-out joint in New York. And he lost his job on Wall Street. And he was put in the town's hospital in New York, alcoholic sanitarium. And while he was there, he had a spiritual experience, a bright light. Something happened to him one night. He woke up and he saw a bright light. And he felt the presence of God. And he was literally struck sober. That's what happened. And he left town's hospital and he didn't know why that had happened to him. He had no idea. He only had some notion that if he could share it with other alcoholics, that he would be okay. It was just a sense that he had. It wasn't anything he knew. It was just something he felt. And his wife went to work in a department store, and he spent his days down in the Bowery of New York bringing home drunks. Wasn't she happy about that? Turns out she was. She was happy about it. And he tried to sober up these drunks. And you know what? Nobody ever got sober. Nobody did. They stole the silver. One person died in his apartment. They had, you know, it was awful. And then something happened. He had a chance to go to Akron, Ohio, to put together this proxy deal, and maybe he'd get his career back. So he went to Akron in May of 1935. And he met with the Goodyear Rubber Company and their representatives, and he tried to put this proxy together, and you know what he did? He blew it. It fell through. Didn't work. And the weekend, that was on a Friday. And he found himself on Saturday, all alone in Akron, Ohio, depressed, down, defeated, but sober for 6 months after this bright light experience. And he found himself in the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel in Akron, Ohio, at noon on Saturday, May 11th, 1935. And he had to go home and tell his wife about one more failure. And he was terribly depressed, and he didn't know what to do. And the cocktail lounge opened up. And people started ordering drinks. And he thought, oh, what the hell, I might as well have a drink. Wouldn't you? But he didn't. Do you know what he did? He turned to the left and he turned to the church directory on the wall. And he started to call Episcopal priests who knew about the Oxford movement, who could put him in touch with other members of the Oxford movement, who might know some drunk that he could go talk to one more time. Would you do that? He had no sponsor to call, no home group, no support system. And he called 10 people. He got 10 names. And 9 of them had knew nobody. And the 10th name led him to a woman named Henrietta Seiberling from the Goodyear Rubber Company, who was a member of the Oxford Movement, who knew a drunken doctor who was about to have his license taken away in Akron, Ohio. And they arranged a visit for the next day. And as a result of that meeting, the very first AA meeting, you and I are here today. And I think the most wonderful thing about that story is that the stockbroker brought the message to the doctor. It's not scientific. It is a gift from God. If you're new, take it. It is yours. Thank you.